It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. You'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM and to the first Older Women Live show of the year. For those of us who listen to us, you know that we are feminist radio from an elderly perspective. And tonight, Laurie Yaris and I, Laurie Yaris is a collective member and so am I, and we've worked together for about, 40 years, Laura?
Yeah, radio. About that. I have to calculate it out, but definitely around that.
So Laura and I are old radio buddies. Tonight we're going to talk about something that we have in common, which is that both our grandmothers died in Auschwitz. So we're going to start by talking a little bit about our grandmothers, because this topic, the Holocaust, of course, and what's happening in the Middle East, in Gaza, are the topics that are in the news of interest all the time to everybody. So we're going to look at them tonight, starting with our grandmothers. So why don't you go first, Laura? Tell me about your grandmother. Tell us about your granny that you never knew, of course, as I didn't know mine.
Exactly. It's like, I always say, it's like I never knew her, but I still remember her. Yeah, her name was Liebe Centnerswehr Rame. Her husband's name was Rame. And she lived in Warsaw. And when she got married, she immigrated to Belgium. My grandfather apparently went first, and he was looking for work. And then he went back to Warsaw and they got married there. And then she immigrated to Belgium as well. So they were living in Brussels and they were factory workers. They were known as ouvriers maroquiniers, which means leather workers. I think they made hats and ladies' handbags, that kind of thing. So they were quite poor. And I think whatever spare money they had, they sent back to Poland because they each had many siblings. They were both from large families. So they were basically working class people, factory workers. So they were there for a number of years. My mother was born in 1932. And then, of course, the war broke out in 39 and Belgium became occupied. I think it was around 1941 because the Nazis invaded France first and then came into Belgium. And they actually tried to escape. They didn't know where the Germans actually were. And they walked to the Belgium France border and they crossed the border. And then they saw a convoy of Germans, you know, some were marching and they were in trucks and tanks and all that. And they were coming towards them. So they jumped in a ditch and they waited for the convoy to pass. And they realized it's no point because the Germans had overtaken France. So they turned around 180 and they walked back home. So they were living under the occupation of the Germans. And then they took my mother, who at that time was about 10, they took her to a place in the country, a farm
This is
where.
your friend. This is her parents, not the German soldiers, huh? Her
Oh,
parents
my.
took it.
Yeah, her parents. Yeah. I mean, they were the German soldiers were everywhere. They'd overtaken Belgium and the neighboring countries as well. So. Under that occupation, they took her to the countryside to a farm. And there was a woman there who accepted to house Jewish children. So they left her there. They went back to the city. And every Sunday, there was a streetcar line. And at the end of the streetcar line, there was a stop. And that's near where my mother was on this farm. So she would go and meet them at the streetcar stop, and they'd have a visit on Sunday. But one Sunday, she waited all day and they never showed up and she never saw them again. And it turned out later, she found out that they had moved apartments without reporting it. Because in those days, if you moved address, you had to tell the prefect or the police or something. And they didn't do that because they were trying to hide. So they moved to a different apartment and apparently they were denounced by a neighbor. And they were rounded up by the Nazis. You know, they would do these raids. So they were taken in one of these raids and they were taken to a place outside Brussels called Malines, where the Germans would gather the Jews. And I have a document actually that has a list for a transport, ironically enough, transport 18, which if you do Hebrew numerology, and you reverse the letters because it's like Roman numerals. The letters represent numbers. So the number 18 spells out the word life, chai, in Hebrew, ironically enough. So on transport number 18, there was a list of people, including my grandparents. And I have a copy of that document. And my mother never saw them again. When the war was over, my mother was, she had been hidden in different institutions with false papers. So she had to pretend to be a Catholic girl, and she was hidden in a convent for a year. And then she was taken and placed in different orphanage homes and with her false papers. And at the end of the war, she was back in Brussels in a kind of an orphanage home. And every now and then, some of the Jewish children, their parents would come back and there would be a happy reunion. And unfortunately, my mother. The only people that came back for her were an elderly aunt and her cousin, the elderly aunt's daughter, who was the cousin of my mother's, but her parents never came back. And my mother had a friend, a girl her age. Her mother came back. So they called her into the director's office, and the mother took my mother into a separate room and told her that she had seen my grandmother in Auschwitz. Alive in 1944. So the last thing we know about her whereabouts was Auschwitz sometime in 1944. She never came back. So I think we know what happened. And my grandfather, we don't know, but he was also taken there. So and he never came back either. My mother had her, each of her parents had about 13 siblings and their families. And the only people that survived, my mother had three cousins and one elderly aunt who survived out of all those people. Most of them were in Warsaw, and they were probably taken in the ghetto and I guess probably taken to Treblinka. And that was the end of that. So basically, that's the story of my grandmother. I don't know much more about her than that, really, just that she was a factory worker. That's all I know.
What was your mother's name?
My mother's name was Esther Toba.
Well, my grandmother, it was a different story, and it was the same as well. My grandmother was born in 1894. Her name was Edith Juliana Salomonson. And she was also born in what was then Poland, in the north area of Poland, not too far from the city of Poznan. Now, her situation was quite different, I think, from your grandmother, in that my grandmother was born into a very wealthy, cultivated family. They were the leaders of the Jewish community. And there are three big houses that there to this day, and one of them was theirs, but I don't know which one. She was sent to a private school in the local bigger city, which was called Bydgoszcz. And then she went to finishing school in Switzerland, believe it or not. It was amazing. They were bankers from a big, important banking family. And they were actually, if you know the history, Germany unified in 1870, and all the little states like Schleswig-Holstein and Prussia and everything, they all got together and became Germany in 1870. And they invited the educated Jews, those that understood money and finance, to have quite important roles in the new Germany. And so that my grandmother was from that kind of a family. She lost her husband quite early. He died of leukemia at the beginning of 1928. And she was, how old was she then? She was maybe in her early 30s. She got two kids, but having money, she was somewhat protected. So they had people to cook and clean and do everything. And my grandmother had a job as what they called a procurista, which we would call a stockbroker. Now, women were not regular stockbrokers, but because Edith was from a very privileged financial family, she was able to do that job. What happened was that her children, she had to send them out of the country. Things got worse and worse, and they were in Berlin, which was the center of everything. And so her younger child, my uncle, was 15 or 16, and she managed to get him on a kinder transport, which took him to safety in the UK. They'd arranged for foster parents in the UK, and the children went on by train. I think 10,000 children were saved that way. But my mother, the older child, was too old by this time. She was 18 or 19. And she went to stay with her father's brother, whom she did not get on with, and his wife, in London. I think the problem was, for very privileged Jews, and it was a problem really, was to try to get rid of their Jewishness, that they wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be part of Germany. This Jewish thing hanging over their heads was really difficult for them. And so they had different ways of doing that. Some of them converted to Catholicism. That was one thing that they did. And that was what my mother's father's brother did. He converted. So when my mother was living in London with her family, it was one priest after the next nun that would walk into their house. My grandmother, meanwhile, was alone in Germany, in Berlin. And she was obviously a very courageous woman, Edith was. She went underground. She refused this business of reporting to different places, you know. And they were actively looking for her because they knew she came from money. And eventually, alas, she was hiding. She was literally hiding in a basement in a house on Große Hamburger Straße in Berlin. I've been to the place. I didn't go in, but I've seen it from the outside. There was a group of people who were hiding there. This was July of 1944. So she'd managed to hide for about 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
She must have had help because they didn't have food cards, you don't forget. Anyway, she was denounced by a Jew, by a guy from Romania and his wife. Now, the reason that I know the story is true is that the Germans, as you know, were wonderful at keeping records. Marvelous. So you were saying that your grandmother was on transport 18 from wherever to wherever. Mine was on transport 55 from Berlin. By then, it was a small, small transport. There were not too many people left, just the stragglers at the end. And she was taken to Auschwitz, but she was not working in Auschwitz. She went straight to a gas chamber. That's the story of Edith. And that was on the 12th of July, 1944, that she was taken.
Wow. Yeah, maybe they allowed my grandmother to live because she was a worker. She was a sewing worker. So, I know that they would put them to slave labor to make uniforms and different things in these camps. You know, it was a source of slave labor for them, too. So maybe that's why she was alive that long. Who knows?
Well, it took my mother and her brother years to find out what happened to Edith. And it was a terribly sad day when they found out that she'd been in Auschwitz, which was considered the worst camp.
Well, and you also did a lot of research to find out, like, how she got there.
I went back. I went there. I went to Poland, where she was born, and I went to Berlin a few times. Yes, you have to look in all the archives. My mother was totally distraught and never recovered. What about your mother? My mother never recovered.
No, mine didn't either. I say to people, it governed her life. She ended up in Canada after the war. There were people that came around. There were some Canadian families that wanted to adopt Jewish orphans. And because her family, I mean, she had this elderly aunt and a cousin who were very poor, so they couldn't take her in. That's why she stayed at that institution, because they couldn't afford to keep her. And she was about 15, 16. So she decided to leave. And she left in, maybe it was 47 or 48. And she ended up in Calgary with an elderly couple who actually wanted a boy to help in their store. So they, you know, they gave her the basics, but, you know, they were not really warm people. And they were disappointed that, I think she stayed in school for maybe a year, and she didn't really like school, so she ended up working in a bookstore. But some of her friends who she came over on the boat with were in Montreal, and so one of the friends of hers she was close with wrote her and said, why don't you come here? You know, they speak French here, and, you know, it's a bigger city and whatever. So she decided, okay. She kind of aged out of the system. There was a kind of a organization that supported these Jewish orphans. But when you reached 16 or 17, whatever, they weren't responsible for you anymore. So she got on a train and she came to Montreal, and she ended up meeting my dad on a blind date, and they ended up getting married. But the demons came back to haunt her pretty quick.
Well, my mother, she couldn't stand living with the aunt and the uncle in London, even though they lived in this incredibly beautiful apartment building. So the day she was 21, that was the first day she could do this, my mother joined the British Army. And that could have killed two birds with one stone. It got out of the house of her uncle, where she was so unhappy. And she also felt that she was contributing to the downfall of Hitler. So my mother joined the British Army as a cook. And the first person that she met was my father. Now, my father was much older. He was twice the age of my mother, because he was too old to be sent to fight in Europe. So what they did with the old soldiers, I mean, my father had done his service in 25 years he'd done by then. They put them to work on the home front, watching fire bombs and all this kind of stuff. So my mother became a cook in the sergeant's mess and met my father. And as you say, the rest is history. Except that my mother was marked by this, the sorrow all her life. And yours too, Laura. They never got beyond it.
No, like by the time I was about 12, I remember, she started acting strangely and things got worse and worse. And I remember one day I came home and she was acting really weird. And she had some photos of her parents or her mother. She never had one of her dad. And it was turned down, like face down on her dresser. And And she was acting really, really strangely. And you know, it turned out basically she was having some kind of breakdown. In those days, they called it nervous breakdown. But I think now they call it PTSD. You know, from then on, she always had psychological issues and she was on and off medication. And, you know, she would hear voices. It was funny because really she spent most of her life speaking English, but the voices always spoke to her in Yiddish or occasionally in French because her first language was Yiddish when she was with her parents, right? They spoke Yiddish at home and then French in the streets because Brussels was a primarily French-speaking city. So anytime she heard the voices, they were always in Yiddish or in French.
My mother also had psychological issues, a lot of psychological issues. But you see, in Britain, we were very, very poor because my father was not educated or anything. And money was extremely tight. There were three kids. I was the first kid. And my mother had terrible issues all the time. And she felt totally alienated from everybody. Nobody understood. And my mother wasn't going to say that she was a German Jew, but she was. In England, where they'd had two major wars against Germany.
Right.
There were people in our neighborhood who had lost sons in the First War or husbands in the First War and then sons in the Second War. So it was, England was very, very scarred by Germany. And my mother could never say who she really was. She would sort of try to pretend that she was from Scotland or something with her accent. So yes, it was a very difficult childhood that we had.
Yeah,
she was very disturbed. She would sit in front of the fire. She wanted to be alone a lot in the evenings. And she would cry. And of course, you know, you can understand up to a point, but nobody can quite understand what they'd been through and what that loss meant. And of course, it wasn't just my grandmother that we lost. There were so many people in different camps who never came back. Nobody came back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my mother had one cousin who came back. And that cousin, too, was very damaged. It governed her life.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that was a Yiddish song written during the Holocaust called Strömlin Vögel auf die Zweigen, which means the birds are dreaming on the branches of the trees. It's a lullaby, saying basically that a stranger is rocking you in your cradle, and your mother is never coming back anymore, and I saw your father fleeing over fields in a hail of stones, basically rendering you an orphan. That's the basic translation. And this is in relation to what we have just shared about our respective grandmothers who both perished in the Holocaust. So we're going to continue with the next part of our conversation now. But before we do that, I'd like to just remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3.
Now that we're looking at, let's sort of zip fast forward to what we're looking at now, which is the war, the horrible war in Palestine and Israel. Can you connect our past in any way to what's happening now?
Yes and no, really, because, I mean, the circumstances aren't really the same in some respects. But, yeah, I mean, it's certainly triggering because, I mean, I know a lot of people are trying to equate Israel with Germany, and I can't really totally agree with that. I mean, I think that there are war crimes that are going on, that have been going on for many years, for sure, and there's a lot of wrong, you know, the Israeli government and everything. But I also hear, especially lately, like since October 7th, I've been hearing too many people like trying to gloss over what happened on that day with those vicious attacks. It's like, just because Israeli government is wrong, it doesn't give other people the right to come into a kibbutz in the morning and kill people and rape the women, you know, using rape as a weapon of war, which is very common, of course. Like, one thing doesn't justify the other. And I find it's very troubling because on the one hand, yeah, you want to see this government thrown out and, you know, they're really doing horrible things and it's overkill what's going on. And so there's a lot of Jewish people who are very bothered by all this. But on the other hand, it's like, well, there's still hostages happening and there's still and just the depravity of the attacks. And nobody seems to care about that. I mean, to the point where there are feminist groups glossing it over, like there's this slogan, which maybe is exaggerated too, but it's kind of like the Me Too movement. So Me Too, unless you're a Jew.
Really? I haven't heard that one.
Oh yeah, well, Me Too, unless you're a Jew, you know, and it's because a lot of feminist groups, they're kind of taking sides in a way, and they're glossing over all the brutal rapes that these Israeli women went through.
Oh, wait a minute, Laura, can you give us a reference for those rapes, a reference that's reliable? Because I think that a lot of the problems that we have now is with this social media, we don't know what really happened. Now, I think the figures of 23,000 or 25,000 people killed is reliable. But to me, the big problem here is the weapons. I mean, you know, you can send some missile and you can bring down a building and kill lots and lots of people. That is something that's new. That level of violence, that level is terrible. You know, zoom, and you can be very accurate as to who you killed.
Well, yeah, and those are being sold, I mean, to both sides. You know, I mean, there's profiting by this, right? The manufacturers are profiting.
Absolutely.
By selling these things everywhere.
But I think that we here in Canada, makers of lots and lots of armaments, should be concentrating far more on that than what's happening, what, you know, this group is doing in Israel or this group is doing in Palestine. Because here, if you go to the hospital now, Laura, you're waiting hours and hours and hours because there have been all these cutbacks. Why? Because we're doing other things with our tax dollars, including making armaments and selling armaments with our tax dollars. And to me, that is criminal.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That absolutely is.
Thank you.
And that song was called Rahawan, a very poetic song by Haya Za'atri, a Palestinian musician. And once again, I'll remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. I'm Laura Yaris. I'm your co-host. And as our other co-host, Rosemary Wally, put it so eloquently, the issue in the end is not really about this war or that war. The issue is the armaments industry, both the selling and manufacture thereof. And that's really something that we all have to work very hard to put a stop to. If there were no more arms, then it would be much harder to wage war, and the world would be a very much better place. As you could hear, even old radio buddies like Rosemary and I don't quite necessarily agree on all the facts and so forth. And this is the case with many people and organizations around the world. So I hope that we'll be able to find a solution in the very near future so that this war can stop and that all war can stop. That's really all I can say right now. I don't have any solutions any more than anybody else. We just have to keep working to find them. I do want to let you know that there are going to be some hearings taking place at the International Court of Justice starting tomorrow. It will go from tomorrow and Friday, so January 11th and 12th. South Africa is bringing a case against Israel, saying that it is committing genocide in Gaza, and Israel is denying that. So another thing to complicate this whole issue. So the International Court of Justice is the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, and it holds public hearings on the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by South Africa in the case of South Africa versus Israel. This will be at the Peace Palace in The Hague, the seat of the court. So this is starting tomorrow. In the meantime, we're going to continue our show with some more music.
Refana la,
That was Myriam Ohevatel from her CD Ways of Peace. Myriam Ohevatel is an interfaith Israeli peace worker, and she's been writing and singing music with different groups working for peace, both Israeli and Palestinian, Christian, everyone. That song was called El Na Refanala, which means God, please heal her, referring to a biblical story. But basically, in this case, they're singing about healing both nations, both sides, and just having peace. Okay, we're going to continue with some more music now.
Thank you.
That beautiful instrumental piece was by the late great Kay Gardner, See My Wings Shining. This is from her album A Rainbow Path. Well, we're going to sign off here and go out with some music, so I'm going to sign off right now by saying that you're listening to CKUT 90.3. This program has been Older Women Live. I'm Laura Yaris. Our other co-host was our sister collective member, Rosemary Wally. And we'll see you again next month, second Wednesday of the month, between 6 and 7 p.m. Wishing you all a wonderful year of good health above all, and may this be a year of greater peace all over the world. Take care, everyone, and enjoy the music.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Good day. Hi, I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is a monthly interview with an artist that I share on some stations, both FM AM stations in Montreal, the city, and also through the international broadcast of Radio Al-Hara, a Palestinian-led creative online radio broadcasting project that also is based in Bethlehem. So for this interview, I will be featuring a conversation that I had with Christine Francis, who is a printmaker, an art educator, and is very involved in the Just Seeds Artist Cooperative. You can find them at justseeds.org. Christine recently has been helping organize a series of portfolios of images by artists around the world in support of Palestinian freedom and Palestinian human rights. So look that up through justseeds.org. This conversation is about an ongoing street art collaboration that I've been holding with Christine over quite a few years. We've been holding space together and creating street art, often using off prints from Christine to create lettering messages in support of social movements and calls for justice all around the world. I thought it would be cool to have a moment to share a conversation that is coming from a context of collaboration as part of this series. So here is the conversation with Christine Francis. So I guess often when we think about how street art interventions happen, maybe there's this vibe that there's a concept and it's executed and people just go out there and sort of assert a project. Our collaborations came from more organic processes, which were like conversations, friendship, experimenting with paper, and a lot of print projects that you had been involved in were like reimagined. Like you'd done all these different prints for exhibitions with animals, and also scrap paper. So yeah, I guess first to start, like I have these memories of like just going and wheat pasting a bunch of screen printed animals up in the city. So yeah, maybe just share a bit about like what you're printing, and then sort of this idea, like how do you feel about this idea of like taking prints and sort of reimagining them in a street art context, like cutting them up, intervening in the city, this sort of experimentation of it.
Yeah, I think I love the like reimagining of the prints and the you know, the misprints and what we consider like I could consider like the leftovers or the like steps in getting to like the final project that I would have exhibited. So yeah, a lot of these prints were, you know, experimental. And then some of them were actual prints that I had made, you know, to repaste like years before. It was super interesting to me to have those like come together and have like this new life that you would create with the phrases that you would make, or the compositions that you would make also in the alleyways. And then it was like super interesting as well. You know, cause some of this was, well, most of this was happening during COVID. And it was interesting for me, or like it was cool to see that this was like happening, and then also hearing feedback like from friends who had like come across it was really amazing. They were like, oh my god, I think I came across this of yours, like it was in this alley that I was walking by, you know. And yeah, and just the fact that walking was like such a important thing we were all doing in COVID, just all by ourselves, kind of. Those like compositions that you made, I think were like really important, especially at that time. thinking through those things when people were feeling really isolated.
Yeah, there was such a big sense of isolation. I think walking in the city was so important for a lot of people. So street art interventions in that context, I think were important. The sort of reimagining and remixing of your work in this street art context also, I guess, points to maybe an issue that a lot of people face, like if we're talking about like democratization of art practices, right? Like a lot of people have sort of this barrier between, okay, I have an idea for an art piece, but then like, how do you actually do it, right? Like this comes up a lot in like community art workshops, right? Like how do I express, whether it's like a political expression or like a certain demand or even just an emotion, like how do you express that in an artistic practice? And I think what's interesting in reflecting a bit about this creative practice is it's very much about experimentation, you know what I mean? And yeah, so I'd also, coming from you as an artist who has like found a way to like assert, you know, different projects or have exhibitions, some people look at that and are like, oh, well, how does that really happen, right? So I think it'd be interesting to hear a bit about that sort of, because you talked about like all the experimentation and like misprints that go into arriving at a moment where you're like, okay, this is what I wanted to say. But there's a whole process of getting there. Yeah, so if you have any reflections about that process of getting there and sort of the experimentation involved in that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I go through it like every single time I work on a project. And every single time I'm like, oh my God, this is shit. It's never going to work. Like, oh, like, what if I produce this thing that's just like terrible? And then, you know, I have this kind of moment where things like, I'll like push further and like things kind of come together in a way that I'm happy with. But a lot of the time when I'm working on a project, I have this idea, and of course I don't know what it like is actually going to look like. And so I'm like kind of working through different like visual manifestations of what that could be. And like a lot of times it'll start from a place that like, it's like a very obvious, or like, it's just really cheesy, or it's just like not working. And I'll kind of like move through those, but in print, I usually end up with a lot of misprint paper because I'm usually working through an idea. So, and especially at that time, when I was at Concordia, I was like whipping through so much paper that I had brought with me, mostly because I had it was like very cheap printing paper. But also I was just working through different ideas and I didn't know how I wanted to make them look. And so there were so many with like little marks. And then when I get onto things or something that I think will work, I always make like 5 million of them because I'm like, I'll post those up. I'll like paste them up. I'll make them into something else. So then I end up with an absurd amount of paper sometimes, which is why you ended up with all those like koi wolves and meerkats, because I had. Also, it feels like once you have the print set up together, it's like, why not print 50? Because you already have the thing, you have the setup ready and you can, so why not?
Respect. Going to the point that you just mentioned about these animals, so koi wolves, meerkats, you're printing all these representations of animals that we don't often see in the city for city-based art. I know that there's some ideas behind that. Can you talk a bit about like how these animals came together? I know that you had like specific reasons that you chose different animals that in terms of their actual practices, like meerkats, for example.
Part of this was like there was that show Meerkat Manor, which like also like highlighted the like social interaction and social structure of meerkats. But I had also done research like independent from that. And they do have like a complex social structure, in which like they have like different jobs, and they sort of like live collectively. They have these like series of interconnected tunnels. But what I was super interested in, or what I was using like image wise in the early 2000s, was They have these like sentinels, which are like they're like the ones that you usually see, that the meerkats like standing up, and they like look like their paws are tucked in and they're like looking around. And they are actually like looking, they're the guards that guard against like predators, and then, you know, would warn the rest of the group if predators were around. And I was especially thinking of that as this like watching for danger, but also like just constant vigilance, which really felt like it was needed and important. I mean, always, it's always important, but, you know, in the context of like the war on terror, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, after 9/11, it just seemed like no one was watching carefully. And so I was sort of using the imagery of the meerkats to talk about that, or to like have this sort of visual representation of someone who's watching.
Building on that point, just because it's super interesting and I want to make sure to just grow that out a bit. So when you're talking about watching at that context, I know that you were mostly in New York after 9/11, working as a printer and various projects you were doing there. What do you mean by watching? And like, I understand from what you're saying, I'm guessing that you're talking about social movements watching the powerful in terms of what they're doing, in terms of passing legislation, in terms of like the attacks on rights of different communities, like after 9/11 became so normalized, a lot of migrant communities. But yeah, I mean, I'm guessing from what you're saying, but yeah, can you draw a bit out what you're talking about like the symbolism of watching and the role that activists play in that?
I was actually in Halifax at the time. I was doing my undergrad at NASCAD. But, I mean, we felt obviously the reverberations of that same crackdown on dissent and any kind of, like, basic rights in Canada as well, with the, forget what it was, C-32 or something, C-37, the anti-terrorism bill. But for the watching, yeah, I am really thinking about, like, a critical eye that is critiquing, because it's critiquing, like, and trying to like rein in all of the crazy shit that happened on 9/11 or after 9/11, mostly with the like taking away of rights and just like surveillance state and all of these things that seemed like almost unimaginable before that happened. And it felt like everyone was so wrapped up in this, like fear-mongering, that no one was having a critical, I mean, aside from activists who were, of course, looking at this critically and being like, this is, you know, really, really messed up and it's going to reverberate for who knows how long. So yeah, I was trying to represent, like, it was almost like a warning, you know, like we should be watching, because this is like all around us is danger sort of like closing in, but not in the way that they are telling us, you know?
I find that really important in the sense that there's an understanding that, say, for example, coming to a sense that anti-terrorism bills post 9/11 were something to be super engaged with in terms of like campaigning against those bills, like that was very important, right? It seems obvious now, but at the time it wasn't really obvious, right? Like